From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're coming from the studios of WRTI on the campus of Temple University. And Meghna, it is over. The Democratic nominating convention is history, truly.
While making some history all at the same time.
Right. Well, we've got some people here to talk about it, so let's get to that. Hillary Clinton accepted her party's nomination and made her case for why voters should choose her over Donald Trump.
More than a few times, I've had to pick myself up and get back in the game. Like so much else in my life, I got this from my mother, too. She never let me back down from any challenge. When I tried to hide from a neighborhood bully, she literally blocked the door. Go back out there, she said. And she was right. You have to stand up to bullies. You have to keep working to make things better. Even when
perhaps both a sweet anecdote about her mom and maybe a gauntlet thrown down about what the general election tone might be. So let the general elections begin. In the studio with us here, we have Here Now political analyst Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Good afternoon, I guess we are now.
Where are we? We're just,
yes.
Good day. We're at the end of the week. And joining us from Washington, Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hey, I'm here in D.C. I had to get out of Philadelphia. It was too much Democrats. I'm just kidding.
Well, Paris, you were with us the whole week in Cleveland. Jamal was with us the week here. And I know, Paris, we've been talking to Jamal all week. You've been chomping at the bit. So you start first. What did you think? How did Clinton do last night? How did the Democrats do this week?
Well, starting off with the Democrats, I was very surprised at how unorganized the convention was with respect to the logistics. That was one thing. But getting back to the substance of what the convention was about, I was totally surprised by the level of animosity, I would say, and the level of passion the Bernie Sanders supporters had for him going into the convention on the floor outside. The protests were for Bernie Sanders, and that was very, very strong and very palpable. Looking at Secretary Clinton's speech, I was surprised at the fact that she really didn't give a real rationale, in my opinion, as to why her. One time I did an interview and the gentleman said, why you, why now? And that was a question I was waiting for her to answer. Why you, why now? It was her speech was light on her record as Secretary of State. It was light on talking about minorities, which is a huge voting bloc, especially black women. It was pretty much light on that. And so I was waiting. I was looking for more. But I think what she needed to do was talk about the narrative of who she is to try to make her more understanding, make her more believable and compassionate and more human. So I think that's why it was more of a narrative.
Okay, Paris. So we obviously you've been, as we said, chomping at the bit at this. But Jamal, your thoughts. I mean, I do want to pick up on something Paris said. The country saw Bernie Sanders' passion from, you know, his supporters. Those were a lot of the pictures that went out. How damaging was that?
Well, you know, if you look at the front of this, there was a lot of passion in the first day or two coming from the Bernie Sanders supporters. But every day that kind of lessened up and you could see the transition happening. And by the time you got to last night, it was almost as if the party was pretty unified.
Well, I just want to ask you one thing about that, and then I want you to rip
sure.
on this. almost is key there, because you could see that there were, maybe they might have been a small group, but they were vocal. And you could tell that there were party whips on the floor whipping up the Hillary chants because they came at completely inappropriate times.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the benefit of that is, if you're watching it on television, like I did for big chunks of it, you didn't actually know that there were Bernie Sanders chants taking place because they did such a good job at covering those up with pro-Hillary chants or USA chants, depending on who was speaking at the time. And so everything, to me, really felt, as watching it on television from time to time, felt like it was happening and it was all very positive.
Yeah, and we'll talk just a little bit more. We want to hear more from Hillary Clinton. But, you know, to the other point that she didn't make her case, do you think she did?
Oh, I think this was the most masterfully skillful convention that I've seen in years. They broadened and colored in all the lines on Hillary. And keep in mind, Hillary Clinton's problem is not that people believe she's experienced, not that people believe that she's tough. They know those things are true. They don't understand the context of her life. They don't understand the why. Why is she doing this? And I think she gave a lot of the why. She talked about her family and everything else. It was really great.
Well, let's listen to another moment when she talked about working for the Children's Defense Fund in New Bedford, Massachusetts in the 1970s. This is, and we heard this story, anecdote, a couple times over the week. And I ran into a lot of people who have been around for a while, and they said, I didn't know that.
Sure.
This is how she met Anastasia Anastasia Somoza, who was a young girl in a wheelchair. And remember, she was there to find out why kids were not going to school. Let's listen.
She told me how badly she wanted to go to school. It just didn't seem possible in those days. And I couldn't stop thinking of my mother and what she'd gone through as a child. It became clear to me that simply caring is not enough. To drive real progress, you have to change both hearts and laws. You need both understanding and action.
And Paris Denard, I want you to take this, but I don't want to fill in a little bit. She met that little girl on a back porch of her house. She couldn't go to school because there was no access. And this was, you know, part of the beginning of the American with Disabilities Act. And when she references her mother there, you know, that incredible story about her mother who was abandoned by her parents when she was 4 years old. She walked to the store by herself to buy food. That was a very compelling moment. And when I thought went far in what Jamal, you were talking about getting to the heart of Hillary Clinton. Paris, you didn't hear that?
Well, I did. I don't. Here's the issue, Robin. You have the Hillary Clinton of today, the one who takes hundreds of thousands of dollars from big speeches to Wall Street and in bed with big banks. And so you look at her lifestyle and her life now compared to where she came from. We don't know those stories. And so it's important for her, I think, to go into the narrative of to try to define who she really is or who she was, because what we see now is so different. So I think that was an important point for her to make.
Well, it's a person who's been battle-hardened. I mean, there's no question that's who she is.
She has been battle-hardened. And I think it's important to remember, nobody was wealthier as a Democrat that we saw than like Franklin Roosevelt when he was president of the United States. But it wasn't the class he came from. It was the class he fought for. And in fact, because he had so many connections, he was able to go out there and fight for the interests of working people. And I think Hillary Clinton has big connections in elite parts of the society, and she can use her policy fights to break up the problems.
And she did reference acknowledging that Democrats have work to do with white middle class voters. Let's listen.
Democrats, we are the party of working people. We haven't done a good enough job showing we get what you're going through, and we're going to do something to help.
And so she and Paris, you're chuckling.
Yeah, because that's almost an indictment on almost eight years of the Obama administration. When you look at the unemployment rate, we look at the wage stagnation. So, I mean, I think we're going to have to hear more of that from her, because she's going to have to separate herself from President Obama on some of his economic policies, because especially the middle class has really, really hurt under this administration. So it was interesting to hear her do that.
Well, it's interesting, too, Paris. I just have to jump in, because just about every analyst is saying one of the reasons that Donald Trump has risen is that the Republican Party also kind of abandoned the middle class. But I want to get to someone who truly became, I don't want to say star because that feels so cheesy, but I'm talking about Khizr Khan. This is the Muslim American father of the Muslim American soldier who was killed in action in Iraq. As a hero, he walked forward to save his unit. And this father came out with his wife, the young man's mother, by his side. And let's listen to just one of the things he had, a message to Donald Trump.
Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
Jamal Simmons, how powerful is that?
It's incredibly powerful. I think there are no better stories. And this was the mastery of this convention, because they put the stories in the mouths of real people who are having real problems that were either being solved or being addressed. Or if they had a problem with Donald Trump, it came from the voice of someone like this gentleman who lost his son. And so at the Republican convention, what you saw was the Trump family, and you saw a bunch of random TV stars from the 80s and 90s. But now you've got these
Jamal.
Real people at the Democratic convention who are telling like real good stories.
As Jamal said last week to you, Paris, the President Obama was throwing shade. I think Jamal just threw some shade.
Just real shade, yes.
Yeah. But Paris, doesn't he have, I mean, the stories this week, we only have about a minute. The stories this week, Paris, were compelling.
They were very compelling. And the interesting thing about this convention was that, you know, Secretary Clinton was relying on surrogates. They had a ton of surrogates. If you didn't make that convention stage, you pretty much were on the outs of the Democratic Party. I'm not talking about their former chairwoman, but what I am talking about is the fact that the people that were there were really writing a narrative about Hillary Clinton. And I think they were telling a story that she really can't tell because of the authenticity problem that she has. And so from the programming side of it, from what they did and who they had on the stage, it was really, really smart to try to rebrand her.
Well, I tell you what, Paris Denard, Republican strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, how about we do this again as we head forward the general election? And thank you both so much for helping us over the past week. Paris, absolutely. Thank you. Jamal,
it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Fun times. Take care.
The great mystery horror writer Edgar Allan Poe lived in Philly in the mid-1800s in several different houses. Only one survives, and Here and Now's Alex Ashlock paid a visit.
The creaky door warns all visitors, beware. You just might have a nightmare if you spend enough time in this house, where Edgar Allan Poe wrote some of his spookiest stories. Ella McKenoff is a park ranger at the Edgar Allan Poe National Historic Site.
Poe spent 6 years in Philadelphia, and they were the most productive years of his life. While he lived here in Philadelphia, he invented the modern detective story. He had already come on the radar, the literary radar of the United States, as America's first serious full-time literary critic. He was fairly aggressive, and they started calling him the Tomahawk Man because of that. And then his horror stories were also gaining a lot of attention.
Go downstairs if you dare, and let your imagination roam, in a basement that's eerily similar to the one Poe describes in his story, The Black Cat. That's the one where the narrator murders his wife, buries her behind the bricks of a false chimney, along with, mistakenly, the couple's cat, whom Poe regarded as a monster. Again, Helen McKenoff.
When the policemen come, they've been down in the basement numerous times, and the narrator is starting to experience some pride. You know, he's committed a crime for which he will never be caught. Gentlemen, are you going? I'm so glad you no longer suspect me. By the way, my house is very well constructed. Let me show you. And he starts pounding on the false chimney. But no sooner have the reverberations of his blows sunk into silence than he is answered by a voice from inside the tomb, a howling that sounds like all the demons of hell are burning in agony. The policemen are frozen in terror. They approach the wall, they start tearing it, and they find the corpse on top of her head, solitary eye of fire, red extended mouth. I had walled the monster inside the tomb, whose informing voice now sends me to the hangman.
Ironically, despite that grim story, Poe actually had some good times here. In fact, a biographer said, when he left for New York, Poe left happiness behind. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock in Philadelphia.
Let's talk now about WikiLeaks. The group facilitated the release of hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee this week. You've certainly heard about that. WikiLeaks was also involved in another recent massive doxing scandal. That's the release of someone else's personal information. Just after the recent coup attempt in Turkey, WikiLeaks published links to databases that contain private information on almost every female voter in Turkey, more than 20 million names, addresses, and sometimes government ID numbers. So some security analysts are now saying we're in a new era they're calling the weaponization of WikiLeaks. Patrick Tucker has been following all this for Defense One. He joins us now. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently published a really interesting piece where you quoted several security and technology experts, and they described the weaponization of WikiLeaks. What exactly did they mean?
Think back to, like, the Iraq War, right? And WikiLeaks, when it first rose to prominence, was associated with it with a data dump that they received from Bradley, now Chelsea Manning. They published the data dump in a way that a lot of people said was sort of reckless, but no one could dispute that it also contained evidence that was of the public interest. With this is here, it's very different. WikiLeaks as a platform functions anonymously. It allows different people to contribute different data sets, stolen, hacked, however you'd like it, perhaps stolen from an insider within an organization or elsewhere. And then WikiLeaks looks through the data, tries to verify that it's authentic, has guidelines that allow for the publication of that information, and then they put it out there. What's remarkable in this case is that WikiLeaks actually had an indication in this particular incident that the data that they were dealing with came from a state-sponsored source, that this was a state-sponsored breach into the DNC, that they were dealing with documents that a spy agency had actually taken and was now giving to them for free. They had full knowledge of that that was something that was at very least a possibility when they were dealing with this data set of stolen DNC documents.
So let me just jump in here, because you wrote that WikiLeaks isn't performing a thorough analysis of the documents it's given any longer, or it doesn't care. To you, right, which one's more worrisome?
I'm inclined to actually say that the idea that they don't care is more worrisome. I think that the recent event where they sent out on their social media channels a link to a data set stolen that revealed the identities of the entire female voting population of Turkey is another example of this. There's a tremendous amount of recklessness in allowing your platform to be used as a publishing site by a foreign intelligence service, or any intelligence service, actually, for that matter. The fact that they don't care or seem to care that that's how that platform was used in that instance means that that's going to be a method going forward for other state intelligence bodies to dox, to shame, to persecute people within their countries or perhaps with nation states that they see as adversarial to them using WikiLeaks.
Using WikiLeaks as sort of legitimizing cover. Well,
right.
So let me ask you, I mean, you had mentioned Chelsea Manning and the 2010 documents that WikiLeaks published. I mean, at that time, though, they actually went to great lengths to show that they were being careful with that data dump, right? Because sections were redacted. They even put out an edited video. They worked with certain organizations. It seemed as if they did care more then versus these like big doxing dumps or organizational doxing that you're talking about that we're seeing now. What has changed in that time with WikiLeaks?
It does seem to have changed. There's a lot of people that feel rather betrayed or at very least dismayed by the most recent current steps that WikiLeaks has taken to bring information that they consider vital to the public, to everybody. You're absolutely right. In the original Chelsea Manning data dump, they did spend a lot of time redacting things. Obviously, again, Chelsea Manning serving a long prison term because of her involvement in that indicates that at very least there was some information that was important to the United States government that left, and possibly something that could have imperiled U.S. troops, but no clear act of directly, intentionally putting people in danger or negligently putting people in danger. And that's changed. This most recent event with the DNC, where they aren't verifying the veracity of sources that they're retweeting, and they don't seem to care that material has come to them from a Russian intelligence agency, it does signal an enormous amount of recklessness. I think at this point, trying to explain all of the different changes that the organization has gone through, we're kind of left scratching our heads,
mm-hmm.
Especially considering how chameleon-like Julian Assange is becoming.
Right.
You know, it's he's an incredibly odd person in many ways. He now has a television show on RT, which is a state-sponsored Russian media outlet. There's a great Rand paper that talks about how Russia approaches media. They actually pride themselves on their ability to groups like Sputnik and RT, they can bring a lot of new information to light. They can totally scoop stories and act as incredible journalists, and then at the same time shill for different state parties, different, you know, interests that want to control them. It's fascinating.
So, Patrick, just to be clear, I want to be sure I heard you clearly. So that Julian Assange now has a show on a Russian state-sponsored media outlet, and there is also strong indication that a Russian-sponsored group is the source of these big DNC emails that were dumped on that WikiLeaks did the dump on.
Yeah, that's right. The show's on RT, and there's very strong indication that the two Russian-backed hacking groups, APT28 and APT29, were behind the breach into the DNC.
So we're not necessarily saying that there is a direct correlation between the two, but the web gets ever more tangled, I should say. But let me just ask for a second. I don't recall WikiLeaks ever necessarily professing any particular political allegiance or right. alliances. So to play the devil's advocate for a moment, why should WikiLeaks care where their documents are coming from if they believe that publishing those documents is for the public good?
It's an interesting philosophical question. Does WikiLeaks have some obligation to make sure that different state-run media agencies are not using the platform as a vehicle to carry out geopolitical agendas, geopolitical operations aimed at different individuals? My opinion is that, if you're going to accept stolen property and bring it to the light of the world because you feel it's in the public good, you have to know where you got it. I think that that's sort of the bare minimum of acceptable, responsible behavior as a media organization. And let's be frank, that's what they are. This is a media organization. They traffic in stolen property. And sometimes that stolen property should be brought to light. But you should know who gave it to you.
Well, Patrick Tucker is technology editor for Defense One. He's also the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Patrick, very fascinating to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
New numbers from the Commerce Department today showing that the U.S. economy continues to grow at a sluggish pace. GDP grew at an annual rate of just 1.2% in the past 3 months. That's much lower than what economists had expected. Low business spending is partly to blame, but also a drop in housing construction spending, which brings us to another depressing stat. U.S. home ownership has fallen to a 50-year low. So with a closer look at that, we're joined by Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, and he's with us from New York. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Magna.
All right. So the Census Bureau reported yesterday that just under 63% of Americans own homes, compared to what, 70% of home ownership in 2004? Obviously, 2008 comes in between then and now, but what's going on here?
Well, I've seen quite a few factors being pointed to for this. One of the main reasons, obviously, is demographics. As the younger millennial generation comes of age and makes up a bigger proportion of the population, that's part of it. But there's also still this lingering hangover from the recession. And as a result, builders are more cautious and the banks are more cautious. So it's harder to qualify for a mortgage. And in general, people don't necessarily view homes as this relatively risk-free investment that's going to appreciate in value over time as much as they used to. So I believe it's a little bit of all of that at play.
Okay. Well, there's a lot going on there. Too bad we only have a couple minutes here. But let's dive into one of those things. Millennials, right? So
right.
What is their home ownership rate compared to past generations?
It's very low. The rate for people under the age of 35 is 34%. And that's the lowest for that age group since records on that started in 1994. And there's several suspected reasons. For one thing, the high student loan burdens that this generation has. And also signs that this generation is both more mobile and more interested in living in cities, as well as getting married later and starting families later in life. And again, some of that may still be a hangover from the recession that may normalize in time.
Yeah, but so what does this mean, though? Because, I mean, home ownership for so long has been considered one of those bedrock wealth-building instruments in America. And the idea was, you know, you get your first home and you move up from there. If we have an entire generation of people who aren't able or aren't buying homes at the same rate, what are the long-term implications?
I think you're right. I mean, obviously, owning a house has really been a positive impact on someone's net worth. It gives them the confidence to spend more in the rest of the economy. So there is the potential for this to be a bit of a drag on the economy. Ultimately, though, I'm skeptical that the younger generation's habits and preferences in the long run will be drastically different than previous generations. So as millennials get older and their economic situation improves somewhat, you know, demand for homes could be a good positive influence on the economy. Builders have really been reacting to the demand in the market. They've been building a lot more apartments than condos, for example. So if that demand should shift to more, you know, single-family homes and more, you know, owned properties rather than rented, you know, that on the other hand could be sort of a stabilizing influence on the economy.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, because it'll be interesting to see what the long-term effects are of first home ownership being delayed by 5, 10, or 15 years on average. But maybe we'll still be talking about it 10 years from now. Michael Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. Always great to talk with you, Mike. Thanks so much.
Thanks. You too.
Political conventions are supposed to be unifying events, but both the Democratic and Republican gatherings have highlighted divisions. And while both candidates have fervent followers, both are the most unpopular in decades. A new Gallup poll shows Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump viewed unfavorably by 58% of Americans. But what's bad for the major parties could be a major opportunity for the minor ones. Last night, during Hillary Clinton's speech, Bernie Sanders delegates tried to interrupt her many times, and many were holding signs in support of Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein. Megan Verley of Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio reports.
At the Tanner Gun Show recently in Denver, most of the vendors were hawking firearms and accessories. But toward the back, volunteers were working hard to sell the crowd on ideas, not ammunition.
Right on. Now, have you heard of the Libertarian Party before?
I've heard about it.
Awesome. Have you heard about Gary Johnson running for president?
Yes.
Outstanding. So
4 years ago, Gary Johnson won about 1% of the national vote and less than 1.5% in Colorado in his first run for president on the Libertarian ticket. And the former Republican governor of New Mexico is running again. The state party hopes to see him do a lot better this time. Marie Cochran is outreach director for the Colorado Libertarian Party.
We still get the argument, the lesser of two evils, but there's really no lesser. For a lot of people, they have a hard time, you know, picking between Trump or Hillary, who would be the lesser two. So, yeah, we're getting a lot more traction.
Libertarian Party officials say their web traffic, social media engagement, and donations have all increased this year. That's being fueled by people like Paul Barron. He's a lifelong Republican and...
I've never voted Libertarian in the major election.
But starting last year, the small business owner promised himself,
if Trump wins the nomination, I will be voting for Gary Johnson.
Barron finds Trump divisive, and he's turned off by the violence at his rallies. He's still a registered Republican, but hopes his vote for Johnson will send a message about where he wants to see the party go.
That's the best way to protest. Yeah, maybe throwing your vote away, but at least you're not, you know, joining the masses of Trumpites.
Barron may see a Johnson loss as throwing his vote away. But for the minor parties, winning elections isn't the only measure of success. If their presidential candidate can reach 15% approval in 5 national polls, they can participate in the debates. If they win at least 5% of votes, it unlocks millions in public campaign funds. So just a small shift in voters would have a major impact for them. And third parties see opportunity on both sides of the aisle, from the never-Trumpers to the millions of people who gave life to Bernie Sanders' campaign. Mercedes Maxwell was one of them. She stopped by to chat at the Libertarian Party's table at the gun show, but is more interested in a different third-party presidential candidate, the Green Party's Jill Stein.
I'm kind of swinging her way right now. It would either be her or not voting at all is really the option.
Maxwell first started considering Stein after seeing people online compare her to Sanders. Maxwell says she's always been a registered Democrat simply because that's what her parents are, but she's done with that party.
I mean, you're not going to have my name backing you up, you know, just because you're a Democrat, but none of your policies follow anything that I believe in.
Some Sanders supporters are urging Democrats to resign from the party en masse. They're calling it Dem Exit. Colorado Green Party co-chair Andrea Merida says she's fielding around 100 messages a day from newly interested voters.
In a way, we've kind of been maybe the mushroom political party, in that, you know, we've been in the dark, we've been small, we've been kind of quiet. But now we've got all this exposure and we're the logical home for a lot of folks that did support Senator Sanders.
Merida says that so far the party isn't doing anything extra to try to woo disillusioned Democrats. in part because they're already getting so much attention, it's straining party resources. Right now, there are only around 7,000 active Green Party members in Colorado. Libertarians have 27,000 active voters here. David Flaherty with the polling firm Magellan believes small parties have their best opportunity in a decade to pick up new members. But so far, he's not seeing much evidence that they are.
There's a massive group of people that neither party is really accessible to them right now, but also the third parties have not been able to speak to them either or capitalize on what should be an opportunity.
However, in a year when unprecedented things seem to happen daily in the campaigns, Flaherty says he wouldn't like to make any predictions about how well the third parties might end up doing and how many votes they may take away from the Republican and Democratic candidates. For Here and Now, I'm Megan Verlee in Colorado.
In Poland, Pope Francis paid tribute today to the 1.5 million victims of Auschwitz at a visit to the notorious Nazi concentration camp. And yesterday, the Pope told a crowd of 600,000 that, quote, a merciful heart is able to welcome refugees. But in Poland right now, a right-wing party is in government. Anti-immigration sentiment is on the rise. So let's turn now to Piotr Koszycki. He's a history professor at the University of Maryland. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin by talking about the head of the Law and Justice Party, Jarosław Kaczyński. He is neither prime minister nor the president of Poland, but he's seen as one of the most powerful people in the country. How does he wield that power?
Well, so this is a party that he co-founded with his late twin brother about 15 years ago. What I can say is that he commands the personal loyalty of several generations within his party and of substantial numbers of people in the Polish populace who feel like he represents something different to what's been going on in the past 15 or 20 years that hasn't worked perfectly for them.
Well, he has a great deal of support amongst the Catholic working class in Poland, but I see that he's viewed with a certain degree of suspicion by, say, the more middle class. What's behind that divide there?
Well, so I would say two things. First, there are big generational differences and differences in terms of education, particularly if you look at the 20-somethings or 30-somethings who've had the opportunity since Poland joined the European Union to go and study abroad, then you really get a tremendous difference in terms of them being firmly opposed to Jarosław Kaczyński. But if you're looking at generations that have university educations but feel like in some way they've been held back, maybe they didn't get the European Union grant they were applying for, it's not just about working classes for me. I think that those who feel like they haven't fully gotten to take advantage of the opportunities of the past 26, 27 years feel like this is their moment and he is their leader.
This is the continuing theme among so many democracies in the past several years. What is the Law and Justice Party's vision then for Poland? Do they want to slow down Poland's European integration?
This is a wonderful question, and I think the short answer is that we can't be fully sure. It is clear that they prioritize Polish nationalism. How that's going to play out in the long run, we'll see. But on the other hand, Euroscepticism is on the rise, and Donald Trump and Brexit seem to be fueling the fires of this turn toward nationalism.
So that brings us then to how Pope Francis's visit is resonating in Poland. The Pope has been very passionate and outspoken, calling for solidarity with refugees and migrants. How is that particular message being received?
Well, solidarity was a word that the Polish Pope, John Paul II, repeated constantly in his messages. And solidarity is supposed to represent one of the core ethical precepts of modern Roman Catholicism. Now, Pope Francis has included a turn to the idea of mercy along with that. But both of these ideas are actually, when push comes to shove, seeming rather foreign to the vast majority of Polish Catholics. Some of the Catholic bishops in Poland in more recent months have started paying lip service to some of Francis's statements. But the migrant crisis from the beginning has been a touchstone both for the Law and Justice Party in its turn toward nationalism and for Polish Catholics who are drawing a line in the sand at what they're willing to do as Catholics politically.
So I'm curious, because Poland's right-wing government has refused to take in many Syrian refugees, saying the country is too homogeneous and too Catholic for the refugees to integrate. So in that case, does the average Pole then feel a very deep conflict between their pontiff and their politicians?
My sense, I would say that the problem is a very fundamental one. Francis is not John Paul II. Part of the problem of the Polish church is that when John Paul II died in 2005, the church stopped occupying an extraordinarily unique role in Poland that it had played since he became Pope in 1978. And any successors would have a hard time trying to bring Polish Catholics along for the future.
Piotr Kuszycki is a history professor at the University of Maryland. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
The first lighthouse built in the country, Boston Light, is celebrating 300 years as a navigational beacon in Boston Harbor. The lighthouse is still operating. It's part of a living history museum staffed by the country's only resident lighthouse keeper. It recently reopened for public tours after extensive renovations, and Deborah Becker from Here and Now contributor WBUR took a boat ride out to visit.
On a small, roughly 2-acre rocky island about 10 miles from Boston, the Lighthouse Tower looks just like it might have looked when it was first lit in 1716. White stucco, small black iron doors at the bottom, and a large windowed room at the very top.
And that's the classic look that when you see things like on mugs or postcards or different renditions of paintings.
That's lighthouse keeper Sally Snowman, wearing Revolutionary-era clothes that she makes herself, a long flowered dress, apron, and bonnet.
The dress that I'm wearing today, it is the garb that the keeper's wife would have worn in 1783.
Why 1783 and not 1716? That's because of the lighthouse's long history, of which Snowman has encyclopedic knowledge. During the Revolutionary War, Snowman says the lighthouse was not only an important navigational tool in a busy harbor, but it was also a symbol of British control. So it was a target.
It is not the one built in 1716. That one was blown up by the British in 1776. This is the new one.
New, of course, is a relative term. The tower and the five other buildings on the island that comprise the light station have been repaired, some replaced, over the years. At the base of the lighthouse tower is a small museum with various artifacts, including a large cannon that served as the first fog signal in case mariners couldn't see the light.
It was just black powder that would get fired off to go ba-boom. And they used that until 1851, 1719 to 1851.
This tower was built on the foundation of the original in 1783. 14 feet were later added, so it's now 89 feet tall. The Coast Guard, which owns the property and employs Snowman, spent $1.5 million renovating it for this year's tricentennial celebration.
We made it look really spiffy for it, and now you're out here. So I think we should go to the top of the tower and look at that.
Let's go. 79 steps up, a narrow iron spiral staircase leads to a small gear room that resembles those circular amusement park rides where passengers stick to the side of the walls. In the center is a large round black structure rotating on 8 metal wheels. Above that is a lamp that's under this enormous glass lens.
You'll notice that the light that was flashing every 10 seconds is not a light bulb that's flashing. It's 4,000 pounds of glass and brass rotating.
The lens in this room is what's known as a second-order Fresnel lens from France, which was installed in 1859. It's a 13-foot-tall by roughly 5-feet-around prism-like structure with glass panels cut in specific patterns to reflect the light, at least most of the time.
Because it's an 1859 optic, and we're in the 21st century electronics, there's glitches for the 2 centuries to talk to each other. So it's not infrequent that the light is out.
but 21st century technology does step in. The lighthouse is automated, and light can be provided during emergencies, which Snowman says shows that lighthouses are still important.
There's so many pleasure boaters and small boats, fishermen and lobster women and things like that, that still depend upon that visual sighting. So although vessels have electronics, they have a tendency to fail. And they're going to want to go to that chart, that paper chart, and they're going to want to figure out where they are.
The Coast Guard started automating the nation's lighthouses in the mid-20th century. Snowman is the only resident lighthouse keeper in the country. She says she spends most of her days organizing volunteers and overseeing the property, where she lives most of the time between April and October. And many nights, if you're south of Boston, you might hear her at dusk with her large handmade buffalo skin drum. For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker.
Well, let's end the hour with a couple more voices from last night in Philadelphia.
I accept your invitation.
To be out here with the crowd makes me think of maybe there's hope. It's an historic moment. Very proud it's happening here in Philadelphia. So proud.
Really, if you don't give up, you stay in there, if you believe in yourself, and if you do the right thing, you will prevail. I like her guts. I like her compassion. I like everything about her. She's a good person.
Former Washington, D.C. First Lady Cora Barry. Before that, John Sigmund of Philadelphia, and of course, Hillary Clinton. And as they did in Cleveland, the cheers will fade, and it'll be on to the general election. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy's back next week. It's Here and Now.